Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
When it comes to fitness, what's real? How about when it really, truly fits your life? That's how Anytime Fitness sees it. Because our coaches see you. It's how they build personal plans that work wherever you are and focus on everything that matters, from fitness to nutrition to recovery, all so you can push yourself further than ever or just through the next rep. It's total 360 support for a real difference. That's Anytime Fitness. That's real AF. Visit anytimefitness.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Many people jump away at the sight of spiders. Arachnologist Greta Binford jumps in. She's tracked spiders all over the world, from the dark basements of Goodwill stores to the rainforests of Peru. When it comes to spiders, she wants to know everything. This hour on Point, we're talking about spiders with certifiable arachnophile Greta Binford, the intrepid biologist New Yorker magazine calls the Spider Woman. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Greta Binford. She's assistant professor of biology at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. She's been studying spiders around the world for nearly 20 years. Greta Binford, it's great to have you. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There's so much we want to hear from you on spiders today. We've been reading what you've been talking about and talking with you, and it's just incredible. I should say right off the bat, if you're anywhere near a computer, go to our website, onpointradio.org. There's a terrific gallery there of spider pictures. We'll talk about some of them, video of spiders courting and all the rest. But Greta, I wish you'd just start right out for us the same place that the New Yorker piece started out, this moment last year when you're standing. I mean, you've been all over the world looking for spiders, but here you were, downtown L.A., 235 South Broadway Street, standing in a Goodwill store, trying to argue your way into the basement. Take us there. What was going on?
Well, it's a scenario I've played a few times. Often, whenever I want to collect spiders on somebody's land, I knock on the door, I introduce myself and say, you know, I'm interested in spiders that are here. May I have a look? And so I'm used to being
and they look at you cross-eyed.
With some confusion. Exactly. So I try to explain myself. And usually if I just tell them exactly what I'm doing, I'm a professor, I'm interested in studying various aspects of their biology, and you know, I'm a trained professional. You don't have to worry about me being bitten. So usually it works out just fine.
But here you were next door to the Guadalupe Wedding Chapel, and the manager of the Goodwill store wasn't so sure she wanted you down in the cellar rooting around.
Right. More and more people are concerned about liability, and I understand that. So after much talking with executives and convincing that I was who I said I was and knew what I was doing, they allowed me to investigate their basement. And I'd been there a number of times, so I was pretty aware of what I would find.
It says here what you didn't tell them was that the spiders in their basement were among the deadliest in the world. What did you think was down there, and did you find it?
Yeah, well, it's been known for quite some time that there's a population of the spider that's related to the brown recluse. This particular species is native to South America. It's a big spider, well, relatively big for this group. It's about maybe an inch long in adult size. Mm-hmm. And the brown recluse group is world-renowned for their bites causing dermonecrotic lesions when they bite. Now, what that means is their venom has a chemical that causes skin to die. And the spiders from South America, this particular species, are just big, so they have more of that chemical, and reactions tend to be a little bit worse than the brown recluse.
How did South American spiders end up in the basement of a Goodwill store in L.A.?
Well, some of these spiders actually live in close association with people, so it's not uncommon for them to move around in boxes. Now, I don't want that to cause alarm, but we do see populations of them showing up in places that are well outside of their native range. So this population apparently came up in a box that was part of the costumes that we're coming up with a theater troupe from Brazil. And
years
they
ago,
got
decades ago now.
Yeah, in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And this was discovered. And there are efforts to eradicate them, but spiders are just really good at living in cracks and crevices that are hard to get to. So it's really hard to eradicate them completely. So there was an initial concern about them, but then it became clear that they don't go very far from these small niches where they can survive. And it turns out that the basement of the Goodwill is one of those niches. It's dark down there, and then lights never really come on, and so they've thrived there, and people have tried to eradicate them many times, and there's no known dispersal of them from that area and no known bites associated with them being there. So
though the 1969
concern kind of dwindled down.
Right, the 1969 headline in the Los Angeles Times, "Venom like rattlesnakes."
You know, spiders often get this overreaction to the risks associated with them. You know, with some of them, there is cause for concern, but they tend to be associated with a severe overreaction in the media.
Greta Benford, what got you into the realm of spiders? As I understand, you set out to be a high school teacher. Now you've spent almost a couple of decades in the midst of all kinds of webs, some as big as to trailer trucks. What got you on this path?
Well, I was really lucky to have a professor as an undergraduate who invited me to participate in her research program. And that research happened to be in Peru. And so I went down to Peru and spent a summer in the rainforest. And my job was to sit on a stool and observe this colony of social spiders. All day long, I would paint mark individuals and sit and watch what they did. And that was my first introduction to not only spider diversity, but science in general. And I learned that I really loved the process of science, and I also learned just how little we know about the world and how much, you know, we can make contributions by just sitting and paying close attention to things. And the thing about spiders is they're just wonderfully diverse, and we know remarkably little about them.
40,000 species, you tell us, but social species, like the one you were watching in Peru, very unusual. Most spiders are kind of solo players, actors.
Exactly. Yeah, there are only a handful of species that will live together as adults and not eat each other. So social spiders, actually, they work together to capture prey. Adult females will feed the babies of other females. They work together to take care of the web, and they live together in harmony. Normally, spiders are the opposite of that. If another spider comes into their web, they'll eat them.
There's so much we want to learn here, but I love this story. I mean, are the webs really as big as semi-trailer trucks? Have you seen that scale of web? How many spiders live in a web that size in Peru, let's say?
Hundreds of thousands. And yes, I've actually been on rivers in Peru where the edges of the rivers are just lined with these colonies. And they're kind of like apartment complexes. You see, there are these sheets of silk with spiders living in these sheets, and there are layers of sheets. So there's like the first story, the second story, the third story, and they cluster together and can be enormous webs.
How far up the food chain do they go with webs that big? Are they just tracking flies and insects, or are they eating, I don't know, gophers and jaguars or whatever lives there?
To my knowledge, we've never found a vertebrate being consumed in one of their webs. But these spiders, just for scale, are very small. They're only about a half a centimeter long. But I saw them eating things like large tarantulas, really big tropical insects. And by joining together, they're able to immobilize and kill much larger prey than any individual could. And it's interesting because a lot of the theory that's been used to study lion social foraging actually works for spiders, too.
Did you say lions as in the king of the animal kingdom? Lions?
Yes. Yes, okay. I did. So we know that lions, by working together, can take bigger prey than they can on their own. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for spiders.
You've got their trailer truck-sized webs. You've also described webs, spiders that put their webs in the footprints of deer. Talk about little webs. That's a huge range. But go to the web, because it's the thing we think of first when we think of spiders, the sort of range of structures, the purpose, the spider's interaction with the web.
Yes, and web structures are one of the most sort of glorious examples of the diversity of spiders. The spider you're referring to is a spider in a group called a linophied. The common name for that group is the bull and doily spiders. And it's one of the most diverse spider groups we know. They're everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And there are some species that literally make their webs in the fresh footprints of deer. And the webs are really small, and the spiders live there. So they build new webs regularly, obviously, because deer footprints don't last very long.
Right.
So, yeah, but those are tiny little webs. They're even tinier little webs. Like, I spend a lot of time looking through leaf litter. So the space between leaves is the niche for a lot of species.
Whatever the size of the web, whether it's a trailer truck or the space between two leaves, it's not just about catching their prey. It's a kind of a radar system, as you describe it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about a classic orb web, and what I mean by that is the flat orb that's got a place in the middle where the spider sits, and then there are lines of silk that radiate out from that central point. Now, that's just a remarkably designed structure. So any insects that contact any point on the web is designed to transmit the signal, the vibration signal, directly to where the spider's sitting. And so the spider can turn and orient towards the prey and walk towards it. So it's a fantastic vibratory signaling device.
Are there different levels of sensitivity? Some spiders that are far more sensitive than others, or webs that are constructed for greater, I don't know, perception?
Probably. I don't know too much about the what we know about the different levels of sensitivity. It's true that some webs are designed more to direct information to very specific places. Others, there's more of a general vibration. But the spiders are remarkably good at knowing exactly the point of where the vibration is coming from.
Well, we don't get an arachnologist here every day. We're really looking forward to going deeper and deeper into the spider kingdom. Do people look at you oddly, not just when you're knocking to come into their attic or cellar, but when they just learn that you're the spider woman? Do they think that's freaky, or are they full of questions?
Both. I get all kinds of reactions. One of the fun things about studying spiders is it's kind of a great teaching tool because everybody has an opinion about them. Either they say, oh, that spiders are horrible, or wow, they're so interesting. And so it's a good way to capture attention, and I really love to use it as a teaching tool.
Talking this hour about spiders with gung-ho arachnologist Greta Binford, the intrepid biologist the New Yorker magazine calls the spider woman. And Greta, we've got a lot of people with a lot of spider questions already. Let's get one from Burlington, Vermont. Joe, hi, you're on the air, Joe.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you know?
Well, let's see. I've got just a spider story from last summer here in our little city backyard.
Okay.
So we've got a lot of perennials and that kind of thing. And last summer we noticed, I think it's a common garden spider, a large black and yellow spider. And my wife and I and our then 1.5-year-old daughter basically went out every morning and watched her. And it was just such a great experience to sort of see how she formed her environment. She'd actually really reshaped the bush and pulled parts of it open so she had a large space to work in.
You mean using her web as a kind of a shaping tool?
Oh, definitely. There were strands that, not in the kind of the central part of the web, but further back that had pulled branches to sort of open up the bush and make her web the central feature.
Joe, hang on for a second. We'll play Stump the Arachnologist here. Greta, can you recognize from that brief description what spider this might be?
Definitely something it sounds like an orb weaver. Did it have a flat, planar web with a center that...
Joe?
Yeah, it did, and they had the zigzag pattern. It was a big black and yellow...
yes.
Is that the orb weaver then?
It is an orb weaver, but orb weaver refers to a really large group. What you have specifically is something called an argyope, probably argyope argentata. And they
That's what I was
are...
thinking.
Yes, the white zigzag in the web is something that we call a stable lamentum.
What does that mean? It's a structural element, a stabilizer?
Well, there's been a lot of research trying to figure out what they do with that or the purpose of it in the web. And some of the theories are that it's meant to confuse particular predators. If you think about a spider that's brightly colored hanging out in the middle of the yard, it's pretty conspicuous to birds and things that might fly in and pick them off.
So kind of camouflage in a way, or a diversion.
Yeah, perhaps.
And what about Joe's description of this spider reshaping the bush with its web? They're not just to catch insects, but to do sort of landscaping. Is that common?
Yeah, well, you know, the silk is a remarkable substance, and it's very, very strong. And so spiders can literally weave together a substrate and create little niches for themselves. So perhaps she laid an egg sac that was over in that protected area and created a space for her spiderlings to be while they were maturing.
Joe, what's the climax of your story? Did she write a message in her web before the summer was over? Did your daughter learn to love spiders, or where'd it go?
We just enjoyed her almost, you know, as if she was another, you know, like our cat or another pet. Every now and then we toss a grasshopper in there just to feed her and see how she did that. And it was just remarkable to see.
It's a great story and a nice, easy introduction for your daughter to the world of spiders. Thanks very much for that, Joe. Let me get another from Florence, South Carolina. Howard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Howard. I've got a question for your arachnologist there.
Yes.
My wife, almost 4 years ago, was unfortunately bitten by what we assume was a brown recluse spider.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke to some entomologists in this area, and they say there is no record of brown recluses in this area. I was wondering if she could help me out with that.
Howard, we'll go to Greta with that, but what were the consequences for your wife of this spider bite?
Well, she had to have some debridement there, and she had the necrosis of the tissue, and she's actually had a skin graft. And like I said, it's been about 3 years later, and the lymph vessels in her leg are actually starting to act up, and she's not getting proper drainage, and she's still having problems today and is on some nerve medicine, some Lyrica to combat the pain.
Wow, so we're talking some serious consequences. Greta, spiders, poisoned venom, this is an area of specialty for you. First,
yes.
What about the range and habitat? Does it sound like it could have been a brown recluse?
Well, first, I'm really sorry to hear about your wife's lesion. The brown recluse is in the southeastern part of the United States. They're not as common in South Carolina as they are in, say, Georgia, as you get slightly farther west. But they could be where you are. They often are found in little pockets because they travel with people. The challenge with brown recluse bites is that even though they cause a lesion that we can recognize, there are many other things that also can cause similar lesions. One of the most common, and they're chronically misdiagnosed because they're hard for doctors to diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, unless we have the spider in hand and have actually seen it being bitten, or there are some, at least in academic institutions, the ability to take tissue from a bite site and detect venom proteins in it. Unless we have that, it's really hard to know for sure that it was a brown recluse bite.
Or a spider at all, you're saying?
There are other things that can cause lesions that are misdiagnosed.
Like?
For example, the first cases of anthrax in New York in 2001 were misdiagnosed as brown recluse bites, even though brown recluse are not in that area.
Surely anthrax would be as rare or rarer than a spider.
Yeah. One of the things that we're learning is commonly misdiagnosed is something called MRSA. It's a methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, for what that means. It's mm-hmm. basically a bacterium that causes a similar sort of lesion where you've got local necrosis, and the treatment is basically the same. Now, the reality in the United States is that there isn't a good anti-venom treatment for brown recluse bites, so the diagnosis is really not all that useful. So we basically treat the wound no matter what caused it. There are antivenoms in the works, but they're not yet available in the United States.
Howard, we wish good luck to your wife with dealing with that. And Greta, take us on a little broader tour then of the venomous part of the spider kingdom. It's a deep minority, but people are very attuned to it. What parts of the country, what parts of the world will you find spiders with venom that's an issue for humans? Can you describe that for us?
Sure. And that's a key distinction there, Tom, that all spiders have venom, more or less. There are a few that don't. But and of the close to 40,000 species, only a small handful have toxins in the venom that can affect people. In the United States, the brown recluse and the black widow are really the only two that we're concerned about. In other parts of the world, and I'm happy to talk about those more later,
yeah.
The most toxic spiders that we're aware of are the nasty thing in Australia called the funnel web spider. And this is actually more closely related to a tarantula than it is to an orb weaver, our common spiders in your backyard. But it's not only has toxins that hurt people, but it's aggressive. So most spiders are shy and not aggressive at all, but that spider happens to be toxic and aggressive.
It will jump out at you. It will attack a vertebrate, a human.
Yeah, yeah. It won't jump, but if you approach it, it'll turn and rear its fangs and latch onto you.
Now, these two in the U.S., the brown recluse and the black widow, what parts of the United States might they be found in, and what do they look like so people might recognize them?
There are lots of photos online to see them, but they're pretty distinctive. The black widow is distinctive. It's shiny and black. It makes a tangle of a web, a very interesting web, but its abdomen is kind of round and bulbous, and it's got a red hourglass marking on the bottom of its abdomen. And so when it's hanging in a web, you can see the bottom of its abdomen. That would be pointing upward, and you see the red hourglass.
And where might you find black widows in the U.S.?
There are records of them in every state, but they're definitely the most abundant in the southern parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And drier areas or wetter areas or both?
Both, but more in drier areas. In the desert southwest in California, they're very common. In Oklahoma, they're very common.
And the brown recluse?
The brown recluse has a more limited distribution, and there are a number of species related to the brown recluse in the United States, but the brown recluse proper is only in the Midwest and Southeast. So they basically are found from a line through central Texas up into central Kansas, across over to southern Indiana, southern Ohio, and then down into Alabama and Georgia.
I grew up in that part of the world, and my granddad always said, watch out for the ones with the fiddle on them.
Exactly. That's what they look like. They're brown, kind of a camely brown. And the fiddle is on the part of their body we call the cephalothorax. Now, that's a big word, but so spiders have two body parts. There's one part with the legs attached, and the other part is the abdomen. It has no legs. The part with the legs attached is the cephalothorax. And so the violin on a brown recluse, the handle is pointing towards the abdomen. So there's a picture of one on my website people are welcome to look at.
What is that, Greta, that website?
It's www.lclark.edu/squiggle Binford.
Okay, there you go if you want to see it. Oh, and there's a lot, again, as I say, at our website, onpointradio.org. Let me take another call, if I may, from Doug in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug, you're on the air.
My question is about size. I think that size matters in spiders. One of your earlier guests stole my story about black and gold large spiders. Ours in particular used to have a web that would get dewdrops on, and it was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was large.
Yes.
Later on, I had a large tarantula crawl across my hand. And
surely not in Massachusetts. Where was that, Doug?
Central Texas.
Okay.
Then in South America, I was in a search and rescue group, and we had what's called arañas monas, which means monkey spider, and they are reputed to kill birds and large rodents and even baby monkeys. But what I wanted to ask about is the biggest spiders ever. What were they? I understand there was a period of time in which spiders could grow very large because there was a lot of oxygen in the environment, and therefore they could breathe and grow large. What's the biggest spider on record in evolutionary history?
Greta, then and now, what have we got out there?
That's an excellent question. I'm not aware of any fossil spiders that are bigger than the spiders we have living on Earth today. There are certainly enormous scorpions, which are arachnids, but in another branch. But the largest spiders I'm aware of are in the tarantula family, and I can't even give you a specific species name, but there are some that have leg spans the size of a dinner plate. And they certainly are capable of eating small mammals and do. Does that answer your question?
Just a quick comment. The BBC did a program called Monsters Before Dinosaurs, and that's where I'm getting my information. They have huge spiders chasing reptiles, so fairly lizard-like reptiles,
right.
Not dinosaurs.
So there's a picture to imagine, Doug. Thanks for that. Greta, what about size? Do the bigger spiders have very different behaviors? Not just different food. I mean, you won't find a tiny spider eating a vertebrate, but I know they're longer lived. Tarantulas, I think you've said, can live up to 30 years, whereas most spiders only live a year or less. But what about their behavior of the big spiders?
Good question. They don't really differ that much from their smaller relatives. And the biggest spiders are tarantulas. Tarantulas generally live in burrows. And they have silk strands that come out of them that are basically like triggers of things walking by. But no, the bigger spiders don't differ too much in behavior. I will say, I'll add that a lot of the accounts, even on nature shows, of spiders are very sensationalized. There mm-hmm. are there are not spiders that are a threat to livestock, for example, eating chickens regularly. So they're just sort of classically sensationalized to be more of vertebrate eaters than they are. There certainly are spiders that eat vertebrates. There are some spiders that I'm particularly fond of that that dive under the water and eat fish. So they live along streams on big rocks in North America, and they're about the size of a hand. But they're able to break the surface wow. tension of water and dive underneath and catch fish.
Amazing.
It is.
Let's go to Holly in Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Holly. You're on the air with Greta Binford.
Hi. How are you?
Well.
Hi.
I have a strange story and then a question. I wanted her to talk about another issue regarding mm-hmm. spiders. But mm-hmm. I had woken up one morning in the winter, and it sounded as though I'd been swimming the day before, and there was rattling on my eardrum, and I hadn't been swimming, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And about 3 hours later, as my ear was tickling, I reached up and pulled out a little spider.
Ooh.
And walked around on the eardrum. But what I wanted to ask you about is if you'd talk a little bit about how they're using gossamer and injecting it into goat's milk so that they can spin more of it and manufacture bulletproof fabric.
Does that yeah. ring familiar, Greta?
Yes, definitely.
I'm not sure I understand it. Gossamer and goat's milk and
lay that up. So you're referring to spider silk. So spider silk is just, we know it has remarkable properties. And so a few years ago, the gene that codes for spider silk was cloned into cells of goats. And so there are goats that actually are able of making the protein that is the silk protein. So we can harvest this liquid silk protein. And the hope is to be able to make silk in abundance that can actually be used for fibers. So spider silk has been known for centuries to be a remarkable property. But a challenge with getting a lot of spider silk is that if you put spiders together, they'll eat each other. So they're not like silkworms where you can harvest mm-hmm. lots of silk. So this is an effort to try to harvest lots of silk protein. The challenge is that something that happens to the silk when it passes through the spider's what are called spinnerets. So it goes from a liquid to being a fiber. Mm-hmm. And we're really having a hard time figuring out exactly what happens to convert the liquid protein into fiber.
Must happen almost instantaneously. I mean, you see how fast that silk comes out sometimes.
Yes, exactly. And there are things like there's a pH change, a restructuring of the proteins from a liquid to a fiber. And so we're still working out that technology, but it would be exciting to be able to make things like bulletproof vests. The relative strength to weight of silk makes it really ideal for such applications.
Bulletproof vest, if it works out, what else might be done with that kind of product, with the equivalent of a spider silk fabric?
All sorts of things. It could be, you know, the next Gore-Tex. It's just a really strong fiber relative to its weight.
Wow, that's amazing. Holly, we're glad you got that spider out of your ear. That must be an unusual story, Greta. Surely they're not crawling in our ears every night.
That is. And, you know, I usually tell people that the spiders doing that is sort of an urban legend. So I haven't heard of an actual account of that happening.
Okay.
Interesting to know. I would love to know what spider it was.
Holly, do you remember what it looked like?
Small. It was very small, very gray, and it just let itself down quietly during the night and found a nice dark place to crawl into.
And you heard all about it. That's amazing. Holly, thanks for your call.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, welcome fame, he's ignored, action is his reward to him. Life is a great big day, wherever there's a hang, you'll find a Spider-Man.
We're talking this hour about spiders with arachnologist Greta Binford, a kind of intrepid Indiana Jones spider woman. She's been all over the world tracking them down, knows all about them. Jacqueline's calling from Luray, Virginia. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi, Greta. I have a question about teaching children. I'm more fascinated with spiders than my three children are, and we have many, many spiders sharing our home with us.
You and a lot of other people.
We renovated and moved into an old house that had been empty before we came, well, occupied by the spiders before we came here. And so they are sharing it with us.
Yep.
Including wolf spiders. Mm-hmm. Not just in our basement, but also on our screen doors and, you know, right where we are.
Right. Okay.
And my children shriek and run, and I don't know how much that's just, you know, they want to react. But what are good sources for educating children, besides the fact when I call them and say, hey, come look at this? What are good resources for teaching children about spiders?
Greta?
Well, there are a lot of excellent resources online. First, let me just applaud your desire to get your children enthusiastic about spiders. Once they are, there's a whole world to explore in the backyard. There's a wonderful little golden guide to spiders written by Herb and Lorna Levy. Herb Levy was the arachnologist at Harvard for many years. This is a small pocket guide to spiders, and it's an excellent identification guide and has some tidbits of biology, but it's for North American spiders, and so you can easily find spiders that are common in your yard or your house, for that matter. So that's a good starting place.
Good. A little golden book, and off you go.
Yes, yes. I carry it with me everywhere I go, and I have my students carry it as well. It's a great instant resource for helping to gain some insight into the particular spiders in your house.
And the wolf spiders, Jacqueline mentions, pretty common in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Wolf spiders are one of the most common, and they're perfectly harmless.
What do they look like?
They range in size from about a centimeter to maybe an inch. They often have stripes, which is true of many spiders that walk around outside during the day. So wolf spiders don't make webs. They wander in search of prey. They're both active in the day and in the night. One way to find them, and this is a really fun thing to do with kids, is to go out at night with a flashlight and look around your yard. They have characteristics of their eyes that are like cats, mm-hmm. where the eyes will shine. They have something called a tapetum. And so you can find them with eye shine.
So like cats or alligators, put your beam of light out there, and you'll see, can you actually spot those teeny tiny little eyes reflecting back?
Oh, yeah. You've probably seen them and just not known what you were seeing. They look a little bit like dew droplets, but they're kind of blue, glittery flashes of light all across the yard. It's surprising to see how many are out there.
It's wonderful. And harmless, you say. Harmless.
Harmless. Completely harmless, yeah. So
terrific.
Now any spider, if you grab it in your hands, it may bite you, but wolf spiders in North America don't have any toxins in their venom that are known to be harmful to people, and I've never known of a bite that causes a problem.
Will you feel the bite of a wolf spider? Is it just a prick or an ouch?
Probably just a prick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've never been bitten by one.
Yeah, there's a good exercise with the kids, and have fun with your wolf spiders. Melissa's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Greta.
Hi.
Hi.
This is like the craziest program for me, and it's incongruously fascinating because I am so afraid of spiders, and it's nothing rational. I feel like it comes from a past life or something.
You're not alone.
I lived in the house that the woman previous to me just talked about, an old 1725 farmhouse in Harvard that was infested with these wolf spiders. And now I am, like, transferring this fear to my children. And I want to get rid of it, but I'm wondering if you had any, I guess, theory on why humans have this crazy fear of these little beings that apparently are harmless.
Well, mostly. That's a great question. Greta?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there are a couple of theories. I mean, I think that they're just different, you know, and we're surrounded by insects, which are also very different from us, obviously. But spiders are different, and they have these silk and venom and these wonderful tools that are all designed for killing, really. I mean, they all have to kill live prey to be able to eat. So I'm not sure if that plays into it. I've heard theories of, you know, perhaps this stems from our ancestry of living in caves, but I'm not sure I really buy that.
Is there any sign that you know of that it gets passed down in families? Melissa suggesting she may be just communicating her fear to her kids. Is it in the bone of some of us?
You know, I'm certain there's a lot of cultural aspects to it. I mean, children see people reacting with fear to these creatures, but I'm not sure if I would go out and say that there's some genetic components to it.
And were you always just immune to that fear, or did you get over a hump?
I went through some classic stages. I grew up on a farm in Indiana and spent a lot of time out poking around with things. But I remember a stage in high school when if I saw a spider in my bedroom, I'd ask my brother to come and take it away.
Right. I mean, we've read stories of people who moved out of houses because they were so freaked out, or, you know, had relationships break up because one or the other was so intensely afraid of spiders. It's amazing.
Yes, there's kind of a sad story of in Germany of a woman who was so freaked out by spiders, she sprayed hairspray on them and then tried to burn them, and it really caught her house on fire. it can be extreme.
Yeah, be careful. Don't take extreme measures. Melissa, thanks for your call. Let's go to Imara in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Imara. You're on the air.
Hi, Greta.
Hi.
Me and a colleague are going down to Manu National Forest on the eastern slope of the Andes in Peru.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, it'll be actually our third time. I'm a photographer. I'm going to be putting my lens to the ground, and I was wondering if you could give us maybe an idea of what to look for within the cloud forest region. We're not going to be we're mainly there, not in the lowlands. So I was wondering if you could perhaps extrapolate a little bit on what is to be found within the cloud forest region of the eastern slope.
Oh, boy.
We want to go to the cloud forest. Take us.
Yes, if you want me to come along and guide you, I'd be happy to. There's so much there. But one of the most flashy spiders that's common worldwide but really diverse in the tropics is the jumping spider. They're in a family called Salticidae. And they're out and active in the daytime, and their colors are magnificent. I've seen some in the Peruvian tropics that have bright red and bright blue and silver stripes.
Wow.
Some of them have – there's actually a photo on the website of a Salticid face that's really beautiful with red markings. And so if you take up close-up photography of Salticids is always really, really spectacular. There are tarantulas down there that are beautifully colorful. There will be orb weavers that are out and conspicuous that are really nice and colorful. I would encourage you to there are things that you can do to catch spiders. One is to put a sheet or a shirt on the ground and take a stick and just whack a shrub. And spiders will drop out of the shrub onto your shirt.
Play whack-a-shrub, all right.
Play whack-a-shrub. We have a technical term for that in my field. It's called beating.
Right.
So we go out. You can buy a beat sheet from BioQuip and put it underneath a shrub and whack it with a stick. And you'll find Salticids. You'll find these beautiful spiders called crab spiders that crab spiders are wonderful. They hang out in flowers, and they're often the same color of flowers. And they just wait for pollinators. They can catch really large bumblebees or butterflies.
Wow.
But the colors they take on are really beautiful. They're pink, they're yellow, they're white. So those are some strategies. But I think that you won't be at a loss for finding subjects to photograph.
Pack that beat sheet and head for the Peruvian cloud forest. It sounds like a great trip. Greta, tell us about some of yours. I mean, you've been all over the place in your sort of Indy Jones pursuit of these little critters. Tell us some moments from your far-flung spider-searching travels.
Oh, there are so many. So I'm studying relatives of the brown recluse, and so primarily I've gone to Africa and South America to collect them. Most recently I was in Peru, where we drove up and over the Andes 7 times to try to get to localities to find these spiders. But it's always exciting because the trip is planned kind of like a scavenger hunt. We scour museum specimens, we make points on the map, and they're often remote, and so it takes us to really interesting places. I go into caves. I'm trying to think of a specific example.
You had a moment, I think, in Namibia in Southwest Africa that got a little bit too exciting in a cave, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yes. You know, I've never been bitten by my spiders. But we were in a cave in Namibia, and I usually wear a white cotton shirt when I'm collecting. These spiders are normally not very active at all, but this species was active. So I rolled over a rock, and this pretty large specimen crawled up my sleeve.
What do you mean by large? You talk about dinner plates. What does large mean?
No. Maybe a leg span of the size of a quarter.
Okay.
Or maybe a silver dollar.
Poisonous spider or not, or did you know?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know much about these, but given that they're related to the brown recluse, I can guess that they have the same toxin. And so it ran up my sleeve. I was in the cave with a student from Lewis and Clark and two other colleagues, and the student was a female. And I asked the male colleagues to please turn around and asked my female student to come and help me gingerly remove my shirt. The risk of being bitten by these animals often comes from smashing them inside clothing or on bed sheets. And so she helped me remove my shirt, and we found the spider on my back, and she flicked it off with care.
You're mighty casual about that maybe poisonous recluse relative in a cave in Namibia, but we applaud you. Don't smack it through the shirt is the lesson here.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's
right.
Great. That's great. Joe's calling from Priest River, Idaho. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Yes, ma'am. I formerly lived in Portland and been around the Northwest forever, and I was under the assumption that brown recluses didn't live up here, and from what you said earlier, apparently they don't. And you've done a lot of research on their relatives. Is it the hobo spider? I mean, I hear people getting bit around here a lot. You've seen it, and even in the Portland area. And is it the hobo spider? And what, I don't know, what's the difference between the relatives and the brown recluse?
Excellent question. So it's true, the brown recluse is not up in this part of the world, and but we do have a spider called the hobo spider. Now, it turns out whether or not a hobo spider's bites will cause lesions is somewhat controversial. There was some evidence that they do, but then that evidence has not been repeated. I've actually tried myself with colleagues to see if these spiders cause lesions, and we haven't been able to have them cause lesions. So there's concern about them. But it's not clear if it's well-founded. That said, it's true that there are lesions that show up in the Pacific Northwest. And as I was discussing earlier, it's hard to know if those are coming from spiders or some other source, like a bacterial staph problem, or there are a number of other things that can be misdiagnosed.
Mm. Joe, keep an eye out there. Greta, our time starts to grow short. I wish you'd give us some of the great mating stuff of the spider world. I've heard just a bit of that, but take us into this sort of, by our standards, wild end of spider sex.
Yeah, it's something that most people don't think about all that often, but there's some pretty interesting spider courtship that goes on. It turns out a lot of spiders actively court females before they mate. And that kind of makes sense because in the spider world, other spiders are often potential food. So males have to get the attention of the female and somehow convince them that they're not prey.
What does courting mean? Dancing? Coloring up?
Exactly, yeah. So often you see these males that have bright colors. They have ornaments on them, big tufts on their legs. And they dance and they make sounds. They sing, if you will, by something called stridulation. And what that means is they have hard parts of their body that they rub together and it makes a sound, kind of like a cricket, but it's inaudible usually to people.
Like a cricket, but you said others sound like Harley Davidson motorcycles. What? Really?
Yes.
Like what?
Yeah, so there are some wolf spiders that they rub their abdomen and their cephalothorax together, and the sound sounds just like a Harley Davidson revving up. It was proposed to actually name the species Harley Davidson Eye.
Yeah, you must have some sensitive microphone to grab that one, though.
Yes, exactly. You do have to have a sensitive microphone. There's some wonderful work being done by Eileen Hebbets in Nebraska where she's recording the sounds of vibrations that spiders make. Also, they drum against the substrate. And so because spiders perceive the world very differently than we do, some of them are not very visual. Some of them are. And wolf spiders are both visual. They make sounds. They slam themselves on the ground sometimes, all in an effort to convince females to mate with them.
Come on, lady. And you say, what, mature males of all species or just some? Their genitalia is on their heads. You've got females who eat the males. You've got males who explode after reproduction, if I got that correctly.
Yeah, well, they die. Mating for some males is what we call terminal mating. They don't survive it. And we think that the pressure that it takes to insert his genitalia into the female is enough to be lethal. And there are males that offer themselves to females. There are black widow relatives in Australia that sacrifice themselves by somersaulting their abdomens into the mouths of females. and so they're being consumed while they're mating. So it's a bizarre and very intriguing world out there in terms of spider mating.
I would say so. Greta, what's your holy grail in terms of your career in the spider kingdom? What are you really after out there?
Well, I'm really interested in understanding evolutionary processes that influence venom diversity. So what really drives me is understanding how all the diversity we see in spiders has come about. And this, so I study venom as an effort to do that, and so that's my holy grail. I guess the holy grail would be to see an entire map of the evolutionary history of spiders and their venoms.
40,000 species. Does any other class of creature have that many, that number going with it?
Yes. So spiders are an order. It's like taxonomic grouping. Mm-hmm. There are 5 orders of insects that are more diverse, including beetles.
That's a pretty, of course, beetles, the great one, the great one. You were a consultant beetles. For the Spider-Man movie. That must have been, I don't know, crazy, absurd. I mean, what do they want to know from you?
It was very interesting. They simply wanted to know what a lab that really does spider biology research would look like. And so we took photographs of the lab and sent them to the set designer. And so if you remember the scene where Peter Parker is bitten, part of that is designed with our consultants.
Greta Binford, you're an inspiration. Where are you headed next on your spider trek?
Northern Africa, I hope.
As in which country? What area?
Ghana, perhaps. Wherever we can get permits. Ghana, Kenya.
Wherever spiders are, which is just about everywhere. Well, this has just been terrific. We're so grateful for your time, Greta. Good luck, Spider Woman. And
Thank you so much.
We'll be reading all about venom and evolution. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Greta Binford, Assistant Professor of Biology at Lewis and Clark College, Arachnologist. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.